From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we check back with Jim Amos, editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. The paper has been widely praised for its unflinching coverage of the government's response to Hurricane Katrina and its examination of the levee problems that allowed the city to flood. We'll talk with Amos about what it's like to live in and publish in New Orleans. Also, readings of great poems by famous and lesser-known African-American writers. We talk with Arnold Rampersad, the biographer of Langston Hughes and editor of the new Oxford Anthology of African-American Poetry. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new best-selling country recordings by Carrie Underwood and Martina McBride. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Newspapers, the saying goes, are a daily miracle, and perhaps never has the expression been more apt than at the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. So wrote Douglas McCollum in the Columbia Journalism Review. As floodwaters rose during Katrina, the staff of the daily paper had to evacuate their building. For 3 days, they were unable to get out the newspaper, but they continued to publish on their website. The staff has been back in its building since October 10th. In an article about the paper in the L.A. Times, James Rainey wrote, "The Times-Picayune exposed poorly constructed levees, picked apart obtuse FEMA policies, debunked overblown claims of evacuation center violence, and traveled as far as the Netherlands and Japan to show how other communities have coped with flooding and disaster." My guest is the editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune, Jim Amos. He's been with the paper since 1980, been editor since 1990, and grew up in New Orleans. The paper's offices are located near the low point of the bowl-shaped city. I asked Amos to describe what the neighborhood around the newspaper building looks like now.
Well, you can picture it most vividly if you imagine being in a city at night and all the urban life and lights that we're accustomed to in a city. In my city, if I look out my window after sundown, what I see is pitch black. I'm surrounded by a neighborhood that is essentially dead as of yet, that has no power and no human habitation for blocks and blocks. And 80% of the city of New Orleans is that way. We have become two cities, the 20% that was not flooded, which is up and vibrant again, the French Quarter, the Garden District, and parts that tourists for the most part know. But the 80% that were flooded are very slow to recover.
What about electricity? You say you look out and everything is dark around you. Is there no electricity in that part of the city, and do you have ample electricity?
Well, we have ample electricity, and so do a few larger companies around us, but the residential neighborhoods that are immediately adjacent to us are completely without it. And every night I drive home through blocks and blocks of utter darkness and desolation.
Does that mean no traffic lights either?
You're absolutely right. It means no traffic lights, stop signs at major intersections. In New Orleans, there's the etiquette of how to approach a major intersection has developed greatly over the past several months. And that's just one of the many changed conditions of life here now.
Do you feel safe going home? Do other people on your staff feel safe going home after dark?
Well, as long as one observes the stop signs, I think, yes, I feel safe. There's really nothing to fear except the darkness itself. There are no menacing humans around. So it's really a relatively crime-free and safe city at the moment. But in those dark parts, it's a bit grim.
Does the neighborhood that the paper's in still smell of the toxic waste that flooded New Orleans?
You know, the smell of flooded New Orleans, in my opinion, has been greatly exaggerated. Visually, the city has changed greatly, and in the flooded parts, it looks gray, and the vegetation is essentially dead. But I find there really is no great accompanying smell, and the toxicity also seems to be less than was initially feared.
At the newspaper, how have you divided the pages of the paper between, you know, more investigative reporting on what's happening and what happened, and just more practical information for readers, you know, about services that are opening or, you know, helping people who are still trying to locate lost loved ones?
Well, the investigative aspect permeates everything we do, whether it's on the business pages or on page one writing about levee breaches or writing about how federal money is being spent or whether the levee boards are accountable for the way in which they manage their business. As for the practical aspects, and there's so many of them, we devote page after page to such eclectic items as groups of citizens meeting, neighborhood organizations getting together, when various schools will reopen, questions about insurance, questions about levee reconstruction and the pace of it. Those are really take up quite a bit of space in our paper these days.
How do you stay in business now? The circulation for the actual paper part of the newspaper must be down because so few people are living in New Orleans. A lot of businesses that would advertise aren't in New Orleans now either. So how are you getting enough money to actually stay in publication?
Well, New Orleans has actually, the metro area of New Orleans has rebounded more strongly than I think some national reports might suggest. Already in the city of New Orleans alone, we have, by some estimates, as many as 140,000, 150,000 inhabitants. And in the suburban parishes surrounding New Orleans, we're almost back to 90%. So, and the newspaper's heft and the newspaper's degree of advertising reflects that. So I think we and the community have come back far more strongly and more vitally than anyone, including ourselves, would have believed in those dark days of September.
My guest is Jim Amos. He's the editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. One of the editorials that you wrote for the paper basically said that that there are a lot of Byzantine and wasteful political structures in New Orleans, and this is a good opportunity to get rid of them. What kind of cleanup are you hoping that the hurricane will end up inadvertently creating in government?
Well, one of the most wasteful agencies, interestingly enough, is the agency that controls the local end of levee maintenance and levee inspection, the so-called levee boards. In New Orleans alone, each parish, and in some cases one parish, has more than one levee board. And these levee boards are not coordinated with each other. They have different responses when a hurricane comes. And on top of that, they have other duties that have nothing to do with hurricane protections and levees, such as maintaining a police force that hardly ever makes any arrests, mowing grass in odd lots that they happen to own. It's absolutely vital that Louisiana have the muster the political resolve to unify these agencies so that they're stripped of all these adjunct duties that have nothing to do with levee protection. They need to act as one coordinated force that has one coordinated voice.
There's been a lot of blame passed around between city, state, and federal officials and elected leaders about who was responsible for the disaster in New Orleans. And I'm wondering if you and the editorial board has reached any conclusions of who made the biggest blunders.
I think local and federal and state authorities have been blamed in many cases for the wrong things. For example, the evacuation of the city of New Orleans was a huge success, and yet it is being described over and over again as a huge fiasco. But any city that can empty itself of 80% of its population with 48 hours' notice, which is about what we had after the storm turned, I think can be proud of having achieved a remarkable feat. The bungling occurred, in my view, in the days immediately after, when the people who remained were just not provided for and were grouped together in horrible, almost animalistic conditions that were just subhuman. And that is a blame that I think local authorities have to shoulder and have to do something about in the future.
You know, a lot of people are saying that a lot of the horrible conditions, that people were able to get away with that because most of the people who were in the Superdome and at the convention center were African American, and they were poor. And yet, the mayor of the city is African American himself. So, I mean, you wouldn't accuse him of being insensitive to the issue of race. So, how do you make that add up?
Well, I think the premise is perhaps ill-founded. The conditions were horrific. I think they would have been horrific regardless of who was in those shelters. And they were so because of poor planning, because of lack of coordination. On the part of the federal government, there was an almost criminal negligence in speedily coming to the aid of a city. I mean, this was the greatest urban natural disaster in the history of this country, and the response was not commensurate. The response was pathetic.
Do you feel like you have a sense yet of what the rebuilt New Orleans might look like in terms of how the city will physically look different and how the makeup of the city will be different? The residents, will the class and race and ethnic population remain similar to what it was?
You know, I think I start with the belief that New Orleans, and maybe New Orleans is different from most cities in this regard, that New Orleans has a really fierce pull and hold on its citizens. And even those people who swore in September that they would never come back are now feeling that pull and finding it very hard to resist. And I think that that attraction of the city for its citizens knows no class bounds or racial bounds. And that what we'll end up with is a racial and ethnic mix. It's pretty much what it was before Katrina, but I do think that it'll be a while before we rebound to the size that we were. I think we'll be a smaller city for some time to come, and I hope in many ways a better city because of the various institutional reforms that I think will take place.
I would imagine that in New Orleans right now there's a lot of people coming in who want to help, but maybe also a lot of people coming in who want to make a quick buck. Do you see a lot of both right now?
I saw both very vividly illustrated yesterday as I was gardening outside my house, mostly the positive. I can't tell you how many neighbors stopped to admire the progress of what I was doing. One lady said, "Oh, you're trying to say welcome home," and somebody else walked by with a camera and wanted to take a picture of me next to a freshly planted bed of pansies. And on the other hand, about every 10 minutes, a pickup truck would stop by to pick up garbage bags filled with yard debris. And it dawned on me that the reason for the frequent pickups is that they get paid by the load, and so they're making a killing on picking up readily available garbage bags. And you see that phenomenon in car towing and all the other little trash removal tasks that need to be attended to in our city.
But is that helping, though? Is that helping set a fire under people to remove debris?
Well, it's helping in that it's occurring faster than it would under any ordinary circumstance. I mean, there are literally mountains of debris that have disappeared from parts of the city as a result of this kind of action. But it has probably cost more than it need cost because of multiple layers of contracting and just the kind of wages that you have to pay people to do this work under these circumstances.
My guest is Jim Amos, editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jim Amos, editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Just after Hurricane Katrina, Amos and his staff had to evacuate their offices and head for dry land. Were you in on the meeting that decided when it was time to go?
Yes, it was Tuesday morning. The storm had passed on Monday, and on Monday night, the winds had pretty much died down. But strangely enough, the water continued to inch up, and we found out through our reporters and photographers that the levees had been breached. But you know, we're far enough away from those levees that it seemed still a little far-fetched that it would reach us. Well, when we woke up on Tuesday morning, it became obvious that we were going to be inundated just as much as anybody else, and the water was rising about an inch every 7 minutes. So we we sat down as a group of editors and talked about this. And at that moment, our publisher stuck his head in my door as well. And as a group, we concluded that we had to not only get out, but we had to get out within the next half hour.
How did you do it?
Well, we ran through the building of our newspaper. People were still asleep in their sleeping bags. People were having breakfast in our cafeteria. People were already beginning to work. And we just ran through the building shouting, get out, get out, go to the loading dock. And at the loading dock, where normally newspapers are shipped out for delivery, we started shipping out people for delivery to we did not know where. In the backs of our delivery trucks. We just pulled up a dozen or so newspaper delivery trucks and started moving people into the backs of them.
So if you didn't know where they were going to go, where did the trucks start driving?
Well, we knew that the first order of business was to get to dry land. And dry land was right in front of us on the interstate that borders our building. But to get to it, we had to go through about a mile of heavily flooded service road. We just had that one goal at first, get out of this flooded area of the service road, get onto the interstate, and then figure out what next. We knew that the only exit from the city at that point was across the Mississippi River Bridge, which is about 2 miles from our plant. And it wasn't until we had crossed the Mississippi River and gotten to the dry other side that we parked our vehicles and started figuring out what next.
Yeah, and what I mean, how did you figure out where you could go? You had so many people, it's a big operation.
Well, you know, as newspaper people, we have this instinct about not missing a day of publication. And the first thing that we decided is we have to have a newspaper tonight. And then we concluded we have to send some reporters and photographers back into that city to report on it, and so that we will have a paper tonight. So we gave a group of about 15, 16 volunteers one of the trucks. They headed back into the city, and then we had to decide where we were going to produce this newspaper and how we would set up a temporary newsroom.
And where did you set it up?
Well, we went to a small town in Louisiana, Houma, a New York Times owned newspaper that we've been in contact with over the years, and they helped us produce the first printed editions of the paper in the coming days, and then the rest of us, not involved in production and design, drove on to Baton Rouge, arrived there that Tuesday night, and through some incredibly generous help from the dean of the LSU Journalism School, set up shop at the university in the journalism classrooms and produce the newspaper from there.
Has this experience made you rethink the role of a newspaper in the life of a city?
This experience has affirmed for me the importance that a newspaper can have for its readers, because a newspaper has the resources to know its own backyard and does indeed know it because of years of having reported on it. And there's really no substitute, and I don't mean to sound arrogant about it, but there's no substitute for that intimate knowledge of people's neighborhoods, of people's communities, and what's running and what isn't, and why what happened. There's no substitute for a hometown newspaper reporting in that way. And anecdotally, I would say our readers have let us know that and have told us in various ways how much it meant to them to have that kind of local reporting on a very intense and constant level, both inform them and also sustain their spirits.
The Times-Picayune now has a section that's devoted to Mardi Gras. You know, in Philadelphia, being at this far distance, it seems like the plans to proceed with Mardi Gras are a little controversial. From what I've been reading, some people think it's an inappropriate time to start partying, whereas a lot of people think that it's a perfect time to have Mardi Gras and bring people back into the city and bring a sense of joy back to the city, in a sense that the city can carry on. Have you written any editorials about Mardi Gras?
Yes, we have. I believe that that Mardi Gras is a community celebration, not what it is largely portrayed as on national TV, a sort of a party of college students in the French Quarter. It's a city celebration that encompasses all the neighborhoods of this city and involves people in not only partying but also putting on these elaborate parades and just fantastic music by local high school bands, and it is an expression of the spirit of this city, and without it, we believe that it would be a capitulation of something that's so essential to what New Orleans is about.
Will you be there on Mardi Gras days?
Absolutely. I plan to be in town for the 8-day duration of the celebration and to partake in it fully, as I have every year.
Costume and all? Mask?
We mask on Fat Tuesday, and we encourage all our readers to do likewise.
Thank you very much for talking with us, and good luck to you and your paper.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Jim Amos is the editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
PK, fail me now. My feet can't fail me now. Oh, don't say PK, fail me now. My feet can't fail me now.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Universal Pictures and DreamWorks Pictures, presenting Munich, a new film directed by Steven Spielberg, in theaters everywhere, January 6th. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, readings of great poems by famous and lesser-known African-American writers. We talk with Arnold Rampersad, editor of the new Oxford Anthology of African-American Poetry. And Ken Tucker reviews two recordings in the top 10 of the Billboard Country Chart. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. To create a composite picture in poetry of Black American culture, that's the ambition of the new Oxford Anthology of African American Poetry. It includes a mix of famous and forgotten, popular and obscure poets. My guest is the editor, Arnold Rampersad. He's also the author of a 2-volume biography of Langston Hughes and is a professor at Stanford University. Arnold Rampersad, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
We've spoken on the show about Langston Hughes. You've edited a collection of his poetry. You've done a biography of him. Let's start with a poem by Langston Hughes, which you've included in your new anthology. And why don't you introduce this poem for us and tell us how you think it fits into this larger collection of African American poetry.
Hughes wrote this poem when he was 19 years of age. It's the first poem he published in a national journal in crisis in 1921, and it became his signature poem. He either closed or opened every one of his hundreds, maybe thousands of readings with this one. I think it's an important poem because it epitomizes Hughes's way of creativity, especially in relationship to race, his love of black Americans before it was fashionable to do so, and his attempt in here, in this poem, to subsume African-American history and African history into an affirmation of the beauty and spirituality and historicity of the people at a time when all of those things were being routinely denied.
Why don't you read it for us?
The Negro speaks of rivers. I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and have seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.
Arnold Rampersad, what was your approach to choosing the poems that you wanted to include in this anthology of African American poetry?
I was asked not to do a chronological-based anthology, but rather to come up with some other idea. And I said, well, I'd like to do an anthology that amounts to a portrait of Black America, a self-portrait of Black America, as seen, as created by its poets. And so I divided the poems, all of them, all million of them, as it were, into about 14 or 15 categories. For example, the difficulty of being both Black and a poet in the English language, or Africa, or the South, or slavery, the Black man, the Black woman, death, spirituality, music, deliverance, what I took to be the great and take to be sort of the great topics of African-American poetry. And then I had to choose the poems, and I suppose there are many poets who should be here and are not here, and for that I'm deeply sorry. But I decided that I would include many poems by one poet, if it helped me to achieve my desired effect. I want each poem, and sometimes you have a poem from the 19th century next to a poem from the 20th century, I wanted to achieve some kind of tension and juxtaposition, a sense of dynamism, as out of the collection would emerge, as I've said, as I hoped, a portrait of Black America that was authentic.
You read for us a poem by Langston Hughes, who's a very well-known poet. I'm going to ask you to read a poem by one of his contemporaries who's lesser known, much lesser known, I think, a poet that you include in the book named Fenton Johnson. Would you talk a little bit about him and why you've included him?
Fenton Johnson was Chicago-based. He came on the scene around 1910, 1912, thereabouts. He was associated with a poetry magazine, Harriet Monroe's crucially important magazine for all of American poetry. And he was the first African-American poet to look squarely at civilization and modernism in very, very broad terms. He was at the right time, in the right place. Poetry magazine was publishing, of course, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, and others. And so he produced some a body of work that really there had been nothing like it before in its modernity, in its attempt to grapple with the meaning of the world after World War I. in particular.
Let me ask you to read a poem by him, and would you introduce it for us?
This is Tired by Fenton Johnson, and it expresses his feelings about the world about him, the swiftly changing world about him, but there's a particular perspective that's not recognizably, not definably African-American, but I think it is there. And I will now read it. Tired. I am tired of work. I am tired of building up somebody else's civilization. Let us take a rest, Melissa Jane. I'll go down to the Last Chance Saloon, drink a gallon or two of gin, shoot a game or two of dice, and sleep the rest of the night on one of Mike's barrels. You will let the old shanty go to rot, the white people's clothes turn to dust, and the Calvary Baptist Church sink to the bottomless pit. You will spend your days forgetting you married me, and your nights hunting the warm gin Mike serves the ladies in the rear of the Last Chance Saloon. Throw the children into the river. Civilization has given us too many. It is better to die than to grow up and find that you are colored. Pluck the stars out of the heavens. The stars mark our destiny. The stars marked my destiny. Now I'm tired of civilization.
How come you think he was not better well known?
It's a mystery. But I think that if you compare him to Langston Hughes, the difference is that Hughes would take the same sense of protest, if you like, of outrage, but he would convert it into affirmation, into a poetry of affirmation, of lyricism, of praise, in praise of black culture, black beauty, black humanity. And I think, therefore, Hughes's poetry, certainly among black Americans, became more precious than the Fenton Johnson, who seemed in many respects to be outside of the culture, operating in a way that that made people perhaps admire his work, but not embrace it in the way that that they embraced the poetry of Langston Hughes.
My guest is Arnold Rampersad, editor of the new Oxford Anthology of African American Poetry. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Arnold Rampersad, editor of the new Oxford Anthology of African American Poetry. One of the things I really like about your new collection is that it's introduced me to poets who I was not familiar with, such as Cornelius Eady. Would you choose a poem by him and read it for us?
Well, Cornelius Eady is a wonderful poet. He's just moved to the University of Notre Dame. That's fortunate for that university. He has many books of poetry. Let me just read one called The Wrong Street. And it's about, I suppose, how one discovers the absolute reality of one's blackness, especially if one is a man, in relationship to the potential for violence that's always there, physical violence, but really emotional, spiritual violence from which many of us do not ever fully recover. This is The Wrong Street by Cornelius Eady. If you could shuck your skin and watch the action from a safe vantage point, you might find a weird beauty in this, an egoless moment, but for these young white men at your back. Your dilemma is how to stay away from that 3 to 5 second shot on the evening news of the place where you stumble, or they catch their second wind, or you run up to the fence and discover you are not breeze or light or a dream that might argue itself through the links. Your responsibility is not to fall bankrupt, a chalk-marked silhouette faintly replaying its amazement to the folks tuning in, fist to back, bullet to midsection. Your car breaks down and gives you up. A friend's lazy directions miss the restaurant by 2 important blocks. All of this happened. None of this happened. Part of this happened. You dream it after an ordinary day. Something different happened, but now you run in an old story. Now you learn your name.
I'm going to ask you to choose one more poem for us and tell us about the writer.
I remember many years ago I stumbled on the poetry of Etheridge Knight, who is fairly well known in the poetry world and among African Americans, and a very unhappy life, prison, drug abuse, and early death. In some respects, a sort of classic poet's life of a certain kind, but really tragic. A lot of suffering there. And out of this suffering and this prison life and this sort of deprivation of humanity came just a beautiful body of verse that I think stands up very, very well as the decades go by. And the one I like above all is The Idea of Ancestry by Etheridge Knight. And I like it because while it is written as from a prisoner's point of view, a person down low, the person seeks to remind himself that he is human, remind us that he is human by looking into the past and remembering, you know, from whence he came, and the connections that are essential in order to define one's humanity. The Idea of Ancestry by Etheridge Knight. 1. Taped to the wall of my cell are 47 pictures, 47 black faces. My father, mother, grandmothers, one dead, grandfathers, both dead, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, cousins, first and second, nieces and nephews. They stare across the space at me, sprawling on my bunk. I know their dark eyes, they know mine. I know their style, they know mine. I am all of them, they are all of me. They are farmers. I am a thief. I am me. They are thee. I have, at one time or another, been in love with my mother, one grandmother, 2 sisters, 2 aunts, 1 went to the asylum, and 5 cousins. I am now in love with a 7-year-old niece. She sends me letters written in large block print, and her picture is the only one that smiles at me. I have the same name as 1 grandfather, 3 cousins, 3 nephews, and 1 uncle. The uncle disappeared when he was 15, just took off and caught a freight, they say. He's discussed each year when the family has a reunion. He causes uneasiness in the clan. He is an empty space. My father's mother, who is 93 and who keeps the family Bible with everybody's birth dates and death dates in it, always mentions him. There is no place in her Bible for whereabouts unknown. 2. Each fall, the graves of my grandfathers call me. The brown hills and red gullies of Mississippi send out their electric messages, galvanizing my genes. Last year, like a salmon quitting the cold ocean, leaping and bucking up his birth stream, I hitchhiked my way from L.A. with 16 caps in my pocket and a monkey on my back, and I almost kicked it with the kinfolks. I walked barefooted in my grandmother's backyard. I smelled the old land and the woods. I sipped corn whiskey from fruit jars with the men. I flirted with the women. I had a ball till the caps ran out and my habit came down. That night I looked at my grandmother and split. My guts were screaming for junk, but I was almost contented. I had almost caught up with me. The next day in Memphis, I cracked a croaker's crib for a fix. This year there is a gray stone wall damming my stream, and when the falling leaves stir my jeans, I pace my cell or flop on my bunk and stare at 47 black faces across the space. I am all of them. They are all of me. I am me. They are thee. And I have no sons to float in the space between.
Arnold Rampersad, thank you so much for reading these poems for us.
Thank you very much.
Arnold Rampersad is the editor of the new Oxford Anthology of African American Poetry and is a professor at Stanford University. Here's a composition by Charles Mingus called Sketch 4, performed by the Mingus Dynasty Band. Mingus composed this piece at the end of his life. This track opens with a recording of Mingus singing the melody. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews albums in the top 10 of the Billboard Country Chart by Carrie Underwood and Martina McBride. This is Fresh Air. American Idol star Carrie Underwood's album, Some Hearts, is number one on the Billboard Country Chart. Martina McBride's album, Timeless, debuted at number one and is now number nine. Our rock critic Ken Tucker was struck by the marked contrast between these two hit CDs and contrasts their appeal.
Carrie Underwood's Some Hearts and Martina McBride's Timeless, two more different CDs cannot be imagined within the same genre. Underwood is the winner of the latest edition of TV's American Idol, that immensely popular spectacle of the talentless judging the overreaching. No one makes it as an Idol finalist without demonstrating a ruthless ability to throttle a melody in its musical crib. Over-enunciation, floridly elasticized notes, and terrorizing emotionalism are the hallmarks of an Idol winner, and Underwood is no exception. I played Martina McBride at the top of this review so that you might not tune away. Here, however, is Carrie Underwood with a singularly repellent piece of schlock country called Jesus Take the Wheel, which portrays a woman in spiritual and physical peril set on, can you guess which day? That's right, Christmas Eve.
She was driving last Friday on her way to Cincinnati on a snow-white Christmas Eve. Going home to see her mama and her daddy with the baby in the back seat. 50 miles to go and she was running low on faith and gasoline. It'd been a long, hard year. She had a lot on her mind and she didn't pay attention. She was going away too fast. Before she knew it, she was spinning on a thin black sheet of glass. She saw both her lives flash before her eyes. She didn't even have time to cry. She was so scared. She threw her hands up in the air. Jesus, take the wheel, take it from my hands, 'cause I can't do this on my own. I'm letting go, so give me one more chance, save me from this road I'm on. Jesus, take the wheel.
That's Carrie Underwood blowing her lungs out in the service not of the Lord, but mammon. This girl is so busy selling her soul to take over the record charts that she barely has time to place the right emotion in the right verse. The result is a blaring hodgepodge of romantic self-pity and self-empowering power ballads. The best of these is the title song, written by an excellent craftsperson of such pop, Diane Warren.
I've never been the kind that you call.
By contrast, Martina McBride took a chance in recording Timeless, a collection of old country tunes. McBride has had a solid career going, working in the contemporary country vein of pop-influenced songs. So the eloquent whine of pedal-steeled guitars and fiddles that bursts forth on this defiantly old-fashioned collection was a gamble.
It don't hurt anymore.
Funny thing is, McBride, a modest, meticulous performer, was probably helped in the consumer acceptance of the CD by the recent influx of far more flamboyant, in-your-face performers, such as country rockers Big and Rich and redneck woman Gretchen Wilson. They crow about their hero worship of older country stars like Buck Owens and Merle Haggard, and thus revive the idea that there's gold in these oldies, such as this one, written by Haggard and Bonnie Owens.
Today I started loving you again, and I'm right back where I've really always been. I got a to let my heart
That was Martina McBride making the country safe for classic country music. In her own way, McBride is as shrewd as Carrie Underwood. McBride pads her album of country oldies with surefire crowd pleasers like Loretta Lynn's You Ain't Woman Enough and the Lynn Anderson hit I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. But where Underwood makes it sound as though she's into country music primarily because it was a good counterintuitive strategy as an American Idol contestant, McBride makes her CD sound as though it was music she had to record before her heart burst. It's the fundamental difference between ambition and artistry.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Carrie Underwood's Some Hearts and Martina McBride's Timeless. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of The Sacred Cut, a modern mystery set in Rome by David Hewson, author of The Villa of Mysteries. From the Everett Foundation, working with the nonprofit Medicare Rights Center in support of Medicare for All, online at medicarerights.org. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children, on the web at aecf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The National Security Archive is dedicated to declassifying secret documents that can shed light on history and public policy. It's celebrating its 20th anniversary. On the next Fresh Air, the Archive's Executive Director, Tom Blanton, talks about some of the most revealing documents they've gotten declassified over the years. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.